The following audio is from Christ Presbyterian Church in Nashville, Tennessee, where our mission is to follow Christ in His mission of loving people, places, and things to life. For more information about Christ Presbyterian Church, please visit christpres.org.
Well, hi. If I haven't met you, my name is Stacy Croft. And one thing we did forget is to dismiss our children. And I forget that all the time, unless you're just waving at me, Rick, and like to wave. But this is a time to actually dismiss our kids, five-year-olds to third grade, to the back, to Rick Montgomery, who will take them next door. Most of them, I think, went and took the palms with them. And so if you were expecting to see them again, they're over next door, waving palms at all the kids' leaders. One of the things that I don't know what kind of things you enjoy doing in Nashville or in Tennessee, Middle Tennessee, is I used to enjoy kayaking, whitewater kayaking. There's a lot of great outdoor things in Tennessee, and I used to do it a lot more in my earlier years here, and I never went by myself, not one of those guys who's good enough. I know people that can do that, but didn't go by myself in case I got, you know, wedged in a rock or something. But I remember learning, I used to take classes every now and then over at Vandy, and you could learn to roll, like in the swimming pool, they'd teach you how to roll and stuff, so I got pretty good at that. And I was actually pretty good at being calm under the water, if you've ever done whitewater kayaking, but you know, when you roll, you go underneath, and first thing you want to learn is you don't want to freak out when you've, you know, you're upside down, so that you can like get in your position and then flip back up. And so I remember going with a friend who is way more seasoned than I to down near Chattanooga. There's a number of rivers you can go to, Hiawassee and some others. And going with him, and you know, you wear a helmet and you have the whole gear and everything else. Well, you know, we pull up and everything looks pretty normal. I'm like, yeah, this is gonna be great. You know, the whole while he's kind of like saying to me, hey, okay, just know that when you get in the water, you need to feel loose. You need to kind of get in because it's a lot stronger than you think. And I'm like, okay, well, all right. So I get in the water and man, it is everything that he described. I get in and you feel the force of what is pushing you. And I remember actually at one point flipping upside down and I was, again, decently calm underneath and my head hit a rock. And even with my helmet on, I must have had a concussion or something because the entire way home, my head was throbbing. I was like, oh God. And yet I was in the car like, I love it. You know, it was great because I'm so extreme. But it was, I mean, look at me. Yeah, I look super extreme to you. Huh? But, you know, it's one of those things that you go to and you think you're really in control and you think you have the situation down. And yet, once you really step into it and experience it, you really experience how out of control you are and that something else is. Now, I'm about to read a passage for you, and we finished the Upper Room Discourse, and right after Jesus finishes speaking to his disciples, he goes out into what we know as the Garden of Gethsemane, and this is where his betrayal and arrest happen. And you're going to hear a lot of motion in this passage, a lot of people coming up, a lot of the disciples' actions, and there's a lot of people lobbying and jockeying for control. And then you're going to hear where Jesus is in the midst of that. And then we're going to look at this passage. So hear this, John chapter 18, verses 1 through 12. When Jesus had spoken these words, he went out with the disciples across the brook Kidron, where there was a garden which he and his disciples entered. Now Judas, who betrayed him, also knew the place, for Jesus often met there with his disciples. Judas, having procured a band of soldiers and some officers from the chief priests and the Pharisees, went there with lanterns and torches and weapons. Then Jesus, knowing all that would happen to him, came forward and said to them, "Whom do you seek?" They answered him, "Jesus of Nazareth." Jesus said to them, "I am he." Judas, who betrayed him, was standing with them. When Jesus said to them, "I am he," they drew back and fell to the ground. So he asked them again, "Whom do you seek?" And they said, "Jesus of Nazareth." Jesus answered, I told you that I am he. So if you seek me, let these men go. This was to fulfill the word that he had spoken. Of those whom you gave me, I have lost not one. And Simon Peter, having a sword, drew it and struck the high priest's servant and cut off his right ear. The servant's name was Malchus. So Jesus said to Peter, put your sword in its sheath. Shall I not drink the cup that the Father has given me? So the band of soldiers and their captain and the officers of the Jews arrested Jesus and bound him. This is the word of the Lord. Praise be to Christ. You know, after they would finish this meal, and Jesus has predicted Peter's denial, he spends ample time in the upper room discourse talking to them. They would leave, and often it seems to a place where they would go that was very familiar to them. If you even heard it said, John mentioned in verse 2, that Judas, who betrayed him, also knew the place, for Jesus often met there with his disciples. This is a very familiar place to them. Now, remember, Judas left very early on in that discussion, for about chapter 14. So Jesus was there with the 11, and they left, went to this garden, and Judas enters back into the scene. Now, he knows this place because it was very familiar to them. Familiar not in a way of like public ministry type, but familiar in a way of very intimate, deep, profound, rabbi-student type. And that's what was really, really probably painful and difficult about this. Imagine being one of those 11 disciples, and then finally they don't know in the moment, who is it going to be? Who's going to be the one that's going to betray? Judas has left. They actually don't even know why he left in the moment. And up he comes with this band of soldiers, with religious leaders, and he is leading the charge to arrest them. And not just in a public setting where Jesus is at the temple, but in the place where all of them, including Judas, had received deep, profound teaching and care from Jesus. It's even said that this orchard that was called the Garden of Gethsemane, and it means olive press, it could have even been an olive manufacturing area, was a place that they frequented not only for teaching, they may have slept there a number of times of just camping out under the stars, being away from everything else, that this was their secluded place. So as we kind of enter into this passage, know that this isn't just some like, okay, one thing. It's easy to read the Gospels and read it as this happened, this happened, this happened. This is a deep, intimate place for them. And now it has become infiltrated. And not only betrayal has come to Jesus, they see the betrayal. And they understand it. And everything about their private, loving, deep relationship with Jesus that they've learned for 3 years of ministry is coming unraveled in front of their face. So with that, we're going to look at two parts of this passage. We're going to look at one part is the authority that we see in this passage. There's a lot of that going on, a lot of jockeying for position. Who has authority? Who has control? And then we're going to look at fulfillment. So two things, authority and fulfillment. You know, all of the ministry that Jesus had done up to this point, as I said, was in some ways being unraveled. This passage is somewhat full of profound authority. And as Judas comes up, and it's interesting because John, the gospel writer John, so there's four gospels, right? So Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. If you're unfamiliar with the Bible, those are the four gospels. What you may not know is the first three, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, are called the synoptic gospels. That's a fancy word, basically meaning they all have the same view. They're all written with somewhat of a similar direction. John, his gospel, is the one that's a little more independent. And most of the gospel writers mention the Garden of Gethsemane. You keep hearing me may say that. You actually don't even read it in John's gospel. That's what it was called. But John skips, for some reason, skips this moment of Jesus and them going into that in his prayer and his time to this moment. Because he wants us to see something different. Different than the other three, he's trying to draw out something. And he mentions Judas three times. Somewhat probably because the early Christendom, Judas and his betrayal was really profound, and it still is. But he also says that Judas, having procured, verse 3, a band of soldiers and some officers and chief priests of the Pharisees, they went there with lanterns and torches and weapons. Now, again, the authority here is all over the place. Judas trying to gain his own control and authority. But then you have the Romans. This is all happening in the backdrop of a city and a world where the Roman, you know, world, the Roman government owns so much of the world. And some wonder, why did Roman soldiers go with them? Well, during this feast of the Passover week, which is what we're entering into, even as we celebrate Holy Week, you're going to hear the Passover feast quite a bit. And this is the week they were in. The tensions were high, passions were high. And the Roman soldiers, if there was one thing that they wanted everything to be quiet. Great, you can have your festival, but don't let it get out of control. They consistently had governors and people in place that if the way that you marked a good governorship, your authority, was to make sure that you didn't let anything get out of control in your hands. And so here come a band of Roman soldiers to aid them with that. Then you have the chief priests and the Pharisees, which we've seen all along the way. What's happened? Every time they interact with Jesus, they're going, who is this guy? He is consistently having people follow him, and yet we're the ones that hold all the power religiously. We're supposed to be the ones in authority. And here's their moment. Now they get to come and put Jesus in his place. You see authority all over the place. And really, what's the final one? Well, it's not just them, it's also the disciples. At the end there, you see Peter's reaction to this, and you know it's real in the way John writes it. It says in verse 10, then Peter, having a sword, drew it and struck the high priest's servant and cut off his right ear. Now, we don't know if Peter just didn't have good aim, and why did he cut off the ear? I mean, that's kind of strange. And then his name is Malchus. It's because John wants us to know this happened. This is not just some like fun story being told. This is actually an eyewitness account. And that even Peter himself is showing his cards to say it's out of control. He's trying to maintain control. If there's one thing that I realized walking up on that river is that I thought I could have control in something that I'd been studying, working on, and even somewhat skilled in. And when you're in a moment where you think you're adequate enough to do something, and yet it spirals out of control and your adequacy goes out the window too, there is nothing worse than that. Nothing but fear begins to flood you. And then you think, whoa, what's really going to happen to me? That's what they're all thinking. Even if you think about the nature of the torches and weapons, they're bringing torches because they're expecting when they walk up, they're all going to hide behind olive groves. They're bringing weapons because they're thinking these might be just like everybody else, insurrectionists, people who are zealots trying to go against. And guess what? Peter pulls out his sword and with terrible aim cuts an ear off. It's exactly where it's going. And the control, the feeling helpless, and looking to act as if in control. And here's the even bigger thing. And I think for us and for them, isn't so much us knowing that we're out of control, it's the way that we act controlled. If you notice Jesus in this passage, it would be very easy to look at him and say, look how controlled he is. Everything's crazy around him. But that's not what's going on here. Jesus isn't showing that he's controlled and that he's good. That's what we're used to. We're used to good Instagram posts that show that we're all good, even when we're not. We're used to coming in and acting as if things are just in a great direction. How are you doing? Oh, you know, I'm tired, but good. We're used to that kind of thing. Jesus isn't putting on a front of acting controlled. He is in control. He is the authority. Dan Allender, who wrote a book called Cry of the Soul, if you ever read this book, it's an excellent book. It was written by him and a guy named Trimper Longman. So Dan Allender is a therapist, Trimper Longman is a theologian, and they wrote this book on the Psalms about our emotions in the Psalms. And one of the things when they talk about fear, I think draws out exactly what's going on in this passage, in my opinion. What's what they say? Fear is our response to uncertainty about our resources in the face of danger. When we are assaulted by a force that overwhelms us and compels us to face that we are helpless and out of control, fear is provoked when the threat of danger, physical or relational, exposes our inability to preserve what we most deeply cherish. If you ask the question from this passage, what do people most deeply cherish? It would be very interesting for us to unpack. It would be a great Bible study for weeks and weeks. And yet what you see going on with Jesus is very different than you've got this. It's I've got this. Notice this in verses 4-6. He says, then Jesus, knowing all that would happen to him, which we're going to come back to that, came forward and said to them, whom do you seek? They answered him, Jesus of Nazareth. And Jesus said to them, I am he. Judas, who betrayed him, was standing with them. When Jesus said to them, I am he, what happened to them? They drew back and fell to the ground. They drew back and fell to the ground. What is going on here? Is it a moment of just like dramatic scene imagery that John is writing in, or did something really happen there? Jesus isn't, again, showing that he's controlled. He asks a question that they know. Whom do you seek? Because he wants to draw it out. He's not fit to let it sit within them. He wants to draw out, whom do you seek? And then to answer it, I am he, does something different. He's actually provoking something he's actually said throughout John that John loves to bring up. There are a lot of passages in John, the theme of I am the bread. I am the way, the truth, the life. I am the light of the world. If you do a study in John, he has this way of writing I am statements. And when it gets to this one, it's not that Jesus is simply saying, I am the bread of life, I am the light, I am the way, the truth, the life, which are massive in and of themselves and to the present company confusing, and he has to continually teach on that. This is, I am he. In the actual Greek is referring back to a Hebrew phrase, goes all the way to the beginning, the second book of the Bible, it's called Exodus. When Moses, maybe even if you're unfamiliar with the Bible, you may know that character, Moses meets God for the first time. And when he does, God comes to him in what's called a burning bush. And this bush is burning in front of Moses, but yet it's not being consumed by fire. It's just burning on end. And you can imagine, they're not ignorant that things burn, they go away, right? If something's burned, it becomes ashes. A bush is burning and it's remaining. And he hears a voice, remove your sandals because you're on holy ground. Not because of the bush, but because who is coming to him in this moment, in this figure of this bush? It is God. And Moses says, as God tells him, you're going to be the one that leads my people out of Egypt. Moses, you're going to be the one that I'm going to commission and give everything to lead on, to take my people out of Egypt. And Moses says, well, if I go back to them and tell them that this God that you are sent me to you, who do I say they am? And he says, I am. I am. Weird construction of pronouns. But what it means is that he is self, he is existent. There's no beginning or end. He's eternal. He's the all-powerful God. And Jesus is using a phrase that John kind of teases out all along, all to this moment, when everyone comes with all their authority, and yet at the one moment he says, I am he, they do nothing but fall over. I've been talking to my son, who's in seventh grade, about sports a lot, and it's provoked in me some thoughts about my own history in middle school sports. And it's so funny because students these days, I feel like it's just so much pressure now for middle school. I'm like, son, you're in seventh grade. Let's enjoy this, you know? But I remember back when I was playing football in seventh grade and I was telling him about this. There was a guy that was one of our coaches. His name was Coach Dunn. I'll never forget this guy. He was like 6'5", 245. He had actually lost weight. He was played for SMU and blocked for Eric Dickerson, if you know that name. Now, if you've ever seen the 30 for 30 ESPN, you know those documentaries, there's one called the Pony Excess. He is actually on that team that was for that. So he was one of my coaches. And oftentimes with, and you can imagine now, as a full-grown adult, he's probably not as big. He's still huge, but as a middle school student, he was massive. And what he would do in practice just to be with us, because we didn't always have, you know, we were practicing offense or defense, he would put on one arm pad and then be either the linebacker or he'd be in different positions. And you just didn't want to run that direction. Well, I played running back. I was not fast, but I remember the coach calling in practice a play, and here I come, and I run past him in my old gangly way I did, you know, then. And on my way back to the huddle for the next play, I kind of turned to him and was like, oh, yeah, I got past you. Uh-huh. Not a good idea. Because he just looked up at the coach who was in the huddle, and they leaned down, and the coach goes, same play. And I was like, oh. And I knew exactly what that meant. And he knew exactly where I was coming. It's not like I was fast enough to run away. And as much as I tried, I gangly went through and I kind of moved. And all of a sudden, I just felt myself on the ground like this. And all he did, I don't even think he moved his feet. I think he just went wham like this with that one arm. And with all that force. You know, this passage is interesting because Jesus is not flexing. This is not him showing overconfidence. He doesn't need to do this. He is simply being and reminding us and just peeling back just enough of the authority of who he really is. This week is not a week of sentimentality. This passage isn't us just revisiting a historical moment that Jesus was betrayed and arrested. Jesus in this moment is the same powerful God who actually submits himself to be arrested. This passage turns all of what we know on its head. Everybody falls down, not because he's flexing, but because he is emanating for a second who he really is. And do we know that when we come to Easter, we are not just coming to a God who simply approaches our life, our circumstances, the control that we long for with a posture of, oh man, it's just gonna get better. He has all authority and then submits all of that underneath us even to go to death, humiliation, on the cross. Roman soldiers don't know Hebrew. They don't know the phrase, I am. This wasn't a moment of them going, recognizing, oh, the phrase. The scribes and the Pharisees did. What knocked down a Roman soldier was the power of his authority and who he was. As a peasant, they came out to arrest a bunch of third-class citizens and found what they didn't realize was the most powerful person around, the authority that Jesus is. If you want somebody, don't you want someone in your life? Don't you want to know that in the midst of everything that you think you have in control, that God really is in control? I mean, don't you really want him to be? I know we fight that, and I do too, and we're like, no, I got this. What we need to know is that Christianity isn't a self-help. There's not a you and him too. It's not that. It is that it is all in his hands. And this is why it comes to the fulfillment of even the next. He goes, again, whom do you seek? And they said, Jesus of Nazareth. And he said, I told you that I am he. So if you seek me, let these men go. And why? This was to fulfill the word that he had spoken. Of those whom you gave me, I have lost not one. Jesus knew exactly what he was doing. Fulfillment is not a word you use. If you're going to talk about a great story of someone who's going to come in and die as just a medial sacrifice, as maybe a representation of something larger, Jesus is fulfilling something. To fulfill it, to fulfill something means you come into it, and whatever it was, whatever was spoken, whatever was written, comes to its full flourishing. It means that history, space, and time, and the things that we go through that we want to control, like I'm telling you, there are so many things right now, I mean, in my moment in life that I just want to control and move and shape in this space and time. And yet Jesus, and when John uses that word in fulfillment, is fulfilling all of it. There is not a moment or molecule out of this. So much so that it says, Jesus knowing all that would happen to him. You know, I find it fascinating that John leaves out the moment of Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane. And it's interesting that he references the garden, but he leaves out the moment where Jesus humbles himself in prayer. There is a moment where Jesus actually comes to his Father and begins to pray and says to his Father, is there any way this cup can pass from me? It's alluded to in verse 11. So Jesus said to Peter, after he's like, put away your sword, this interesting phrase, shall I not drink the cup that the Father has given me? What is he talking about? He's referring to a cup that is dotted throughout all of history, space, and time. The Psalms refer to it this way, in Psalm 75:8, for in the hand of the Lord there is a cup with foaming wine, well mixed, and he pours out from it. And all the wicked of the earth shall drain it down to the dregs. Jeremiah 25:15, thus the Lord, the God of Israel, said to me, take from my hand this cup of the wine of wrath, and make all the nations to whom I send you drink it. Over and over in Revelation, in the New Testament, Ezekiel in the Old, Isaiah, this cup is mentioned, and it is to be drunk. Who would drink this cup of wrath? You know what was happening in the garden right before this? Jesus was begging his Father in his humanity, Lord, is there any way this cup can pass from me? He knew exactly what he had to do. He had to drink the wrath that you and I deserve. The wrath that is due our sin. The wrath is that we feel like, that we feel towards what we see around us and in us that we want crushed and destroyed. The malwork in us, the sickness, that is to be dealt with by God's hand. Jesus realized all that he had to do, and he asked, Father, is there any way this cup can pass from me? And then he knew, not thy will, not my will be done, but thy will be done. Only one would submit himself to the authority of drinking the cup, of taking it in, of being crushed himself. This olive orchard that was an olive press was a great metaphor that was happening to Jesus himself. And why did he do that? He took that so that we could take of this table and know that we are not lost. How amazing that part of the fulfillment that what Jesus was doing when he said that was that he would not lose one of them. And all the chaos in that garden, and all the dismantling of 3 years of ministry, and what these men thought was to be theirs, what they thought was going well, entering back into the Garden of Gethsemane, feeling as though it was just a routine evening of teaching and sleeping, and Jesus knowing all that he knew, he would not lose one of them. How tight is God's grip on you and I in this life? It is not about how tightly we can grip to our circumstances and our authority. It is about his grip and his grip alone. And it is so paradoxical for us. We hold positions of power. We see our lives and we have things. We have money and space and time and resources and strength and food and nourishment. And guess what? Jesus was a peasant. A low life that even said, I didn't even have a place to lay my head. And yet in his hands are given all authority and power to keep you, to hold you, so that you might never be lost in his grip. Trust in this, Jesus. You can trust that this week is not, again, about some sentimental thing that churches keep. But we actually believe, as John wrote this, as a real account, that Jesus, through Jesus, the God of heaven and earth, our Heavenly Father, has us so tight in his grip, there is nothing, not one thing, that can take you from it. Trust in that. That's what this table is for. It is not my body and blood. It is not yours. It is his given. So that when you come take of this table and drink of this cup, guess what? You don't drink wrath. You drink benefits. You drink blessing. You drink mercy and grace. You drink all the benefits of Jesus Christ himself, because he drank alone the cup of wrath, so that we may have the cup of blessing and the cup of grace that comes from our Heavenly Father. Praise be to God. Let's stand together.